And welcome to Eastman Financial Report. Today is March 17th, 2023, St. Patrick's Day. Happy St. Patrick's Day to America. Always a big happy celebration and always a harbinger of spring, especially up here in the north where we're kind of eager to see some sunshine and lawns starting to bloom. Anyway, welcome to the show. Of course, this is the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, the host of the show. And it's my job every day to try and interpret or translate effectively the financial news so that it makes more sense to everybody who's not exactly a financial expert. So that's my task, and I'm happy to do it. Of course, as you know, we are a commercial-free network, and we rely very much on our sponsors to bring the quality programming to you every day. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, Swiss America, a fine purveyor of precious metals in the United States. And they're the experts, and you should give them a call at 800-519-6271. Ask them for their free investor guide if you're interested in investing in precious metals, and review the guide and think about it. And if you have any questions, give them a call, because they're the experts and they're more than happy to answer your questions. Again, that's Swiss America at 800-519-6271. Well, today is Bad News Friday. I guess it's Good Luck Friday for St. Patrick's perspective. If you stumble upon a four-leaf clover, you'll have good luck. If you read the financial news, you'll probably feel like you have bad luck. The interesting thing is, on Fridays, negative financial news is usually released. Oftentimes, political bad news is released as well. But there's a purpose in the financial world for releasing news on Fridays. And that's, of course, because Americans tend to take Saturdays and Sundays off, and rightly so, and go about their business and chores and recreation and relaxation. And sometimes we tend to tune out the news a little bit on the weekend. So if you're going to drop a bit of bad news, this is a great day to do it, because nobody will remember by Monday. There'll be more news on Monday. So anyway, the story we're watching today is First Republic Bank in the United States. And that's an interesting bank because it's a relatively new creation, but it was created primarily to serve the needs of wealthier depositors. And they have private banking and concierge service. And it's quite a nice package. If you happen to be financially qualified to be a customer, you'll be treated very well. The problem is, with the national blowout of banks, and of course, the Fed raising the interest rates. If you remember, I was talking earlier this week, when the Fed raises the interest rates across the board to fight inflation, it has an effect of diminishing the value of the bank's reserve holdings, which are held in bonds, which are nominated at, let's say, $1,000 per bond. When the Feds raise the rates, algebraically, the bond market value falls by a formulaic amount to compensate for the discount and the delta between the original interest rate, nominal interest rate on the bond, and the current interest rate. So anyway, when they raise the rates, the bond prices fall. And if you have a portfolio of billions of dollars of bonds, and the Fed is aggressively raising the rates, which they've been very aggressive in this cycle, these bond holdings are marked to market every day. That's part of the bank regulation, that the banks have to add up the value of all their bonds and report it to make sure that they're staying within their reserve ratios. And as interest rates go up, algebraically bond prices come down, you mark to market, and your portfolio is worth less today than it was yesterday. And if you drop below the reserve ratios, you become insolvent, or at least as you're approaching the reserve minimums, your shareholders and your depositors are starting to worry, because they don't want a bank to fail. So anyway, all of this is going on, and it's affecting not only Silicon Valley Bank, which I think we've all talked ad nauseum about that poor situation, but First Republic Bank and others who are in that similar situation, that the portfolio quality is diminished by an increase in interest rates and other, you know, bad loans. As you increase interest rates across the economy, the bank borrowers, the customers of the bank, their businesses are struggling as well. So all of a sudden, the chance of default goes up a little bit, and the risk the risk calculation on the portfolio increases, and then suddenly the banks are in trouble. So what we're seeing is people are starting to pull their money out of First Republic Bank because, you know, these are wealthy depositors, and they don't want to end up finding out that everything over $250,000 is lost, which did not happen in Silicon Valley Bank, and we'll talk about that. But anyway, they pull their money out, and then lo and behold, the assets drop below the ratio, and the bank is in danger of failing. So when the shareholders see that, they try to sell the stock of the bank and get out before it comes down. And most banks' shares are held by institutional investors like mutual funds, hedge funds, and all these types of vehicles. So smart money, shareholder money pushes the sell button. They get out, and suddenly you have a bank that has deteriorating assets. You have the shareholders are bailing out. Their stock price is collapsing, and it puts the bank at tremendous risk. Well, anyway, coming to the rescue, if you remember, the FDIC had, I think it was $128 billion in insurance funds available, and SVB absorbed all of that, okay? And then the government stepped in to backstop the depositors over there. So the point is, here comes First Republic, and the FDIC is a little short on cash. So what happened was there was a consortium of big banks, 11 big banks in the United States, led by J.P. Morgan Chase, which is the biggest of the big banks. They all got together and they said, you know what, as the depositors are pulling their money out of First Republic, we will deposit some of our money into First Republic Bank. And as, you know, as the nervous depositors are fleeing, we'll be putting our money in. And we know there's risk, but we have lots and lots of money because we're the biggest of the big banks. And it was effectively a homemade banking solution where the banks themselves stepped in to save another bank. And that's sort of an interesting problem, because if you think about it, when, like, I bank, well, let's say you bank at J.P. Morgan Chase, okay, because it's the biggest bank, it's the most stable bank. I mean, it's truly a magnificent banking organization in the United States. This is, if you want to be in the biggest, safest bank, you put your money in J.P. Morgan, okay? So there's your money sitting in J.P. Morgan, and boy, you breathe a sigh of relief, and you're watching these other banks go to, you know, circle the drain. And you're thinking, boy, I'm really glad my money's in J.P. Morgan Chase because it's safe. And it is. Well, what happens is when the other depositors are pulling out of these weaker banks, and Chase and the other 10 banks are putting money in, that sort of creates a circular logic problem from my perspective as a customer of one of these bigger banks. I made the decision to put my money in the great big bank because it's safe and I want to be able to sleep at night. But lo and behold, my great big bank is putting money into a rickety bank who I would not have chosen. So I guess the banks are big enough to absorb the blow. And, you know, I understand that you're talking only $5 billion, not a lot of money. But it raises an interesting problem that, you know, the money that's panicked and leaving is, I don't know where they're going. Maybe they're going into Chase, and then Chase turns around and puts it right back into the bank. So you shifted the risk. So let's say you're, you know, a depositor at First Republic. You say, I got to get out of here. You run in there and you give me the money. You run across the street to the Chase branch. You put your money in Chase. And, whew, boy, dodge that one. And Chase puts it right back in. Now, obviously, you're not at risk because you are safe by the balance sheet of, you know, the big banks, Chase and others. So you've diminished your risk, but there is still risk in the system. And I guess if you think about it from the depositor's perspective, the great big giant global bank can handle more risk than an individual depositor. So it's a good thing. And I think it's nice to see that the banking industry steps up to prop itself up, rather than constantly relying on the U.S. Treasury and, of course, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve. So it's an interesting solution. And, of course, when they did this yesterday, all the bank stocks went up. Hey, you know, they're being saved. And now you look at the ticker today and all the bank stocks are because there's still fundamental risk in that portfolio. And, you know, if they substitute, you know, some local business owner deposits for the deposits of one of the big banks in America, there's still risk, and that risk, you know, that risk still exists. But it was a very interesting way to create and save and save the big banks. I did notice that the stock prices on the share, the stock trading was halted. And when you hear that term, what that effectively means is that they're on Wall Street. Let's just use the New York Stock Exchange. It's probably the best known exchange, although exchanges are vastly more complex than they were in the olden days. But stocks will trade and buy and sell all day long. And you know, the prices are going up and down depending on the volume and size of the orders and this and that. And you know, throughout the day, the stock prices, you know, and then it'll trend, but there's always this wiggling in the line. And when market volatility becomes a real problem in the stock market for a stock, the Securities and Exchange Commission oftentimes, and there's a rule, this is a rule promulgated by the SEC, has the ability to stop trading to cool things off. It's basically a circuit breaker, because when people panic and they all try to sell at the same time, the price can collapse. The price can actually go to zero. If there's no buyer and there's only sellers, the price goes to zero. So what you don't want to do is wipe out, you know, pick a number, 80% of the stock's value in a day, because it has ramifications for shareholders who are longer view and, let's say, portfolio shareholders. I was reading a story about old Warren Buffett, my friend. I actually met him once when I was the state securities commissioner in the 1990s. He was a guest speaker at a conference I attended, and it was, you know, I've always been a fan of Warren's. But anyway, he has a portfolio, and of course, within that portfolio is a bunch of bank stocks. They're not doing really well. Well, that's what happens if you don't have circuit breakers in the market. The panic ensues. You can literally run the stock to zero, which will effectively destroy the bank. So these things need to be, you know, regulated, because what you're trying to do in any crisis is slow things down and reach a new equilibrium point of stability. And from there, you can build back, and you can build the organization back, and hopefully the stock price comes back up. What you don't need is a panic in the banking industry. That's not good for anybody. So anyway, we're watching the First Republic Bank story. I think it's interesting to see if the big banks will be lost. I wonder if the FDIC will insure them for over $125,000. It also raises the issue. I asked that question yesterday, and I'm going to ask it again today. It seems to me, under Internal Revenue Service rules, that when you have a windfall, and it's not a gift from a relative or a friend, it's just, you know, a windfall, that's taxable income. So I'm asking the question, and I don't know the answer, but I'm asking the question, if you had $1 million on deposit at a bank and the FDIC insurance covered $250,000, insurance is not taxable. It's basically a restoration of your assets. What about the $750,000? If you've lost it and then the government steps in and gives it to you, is that taxable? And I'd like to know the answer, because when you think about during the beginnings of COVID, when businesses all over America applied for these PPP loans, which are basically payroll protection loans, and of course, if you complied and you spent it on payroll and a few other limited things, the loan was forgiven. And then the first question was, well, that forgiveness of debt is taxable. So I guess the question remains, with respect to this situation, if the bank bails you out, does that create a taxable event? I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because if you have a short-term, if you have a casualty loss, that's a deduction. And then short-term income, you know, does it offset? We'll find out. I'm sure somebody will be asking that question in the future. And it's only relevant because this hasn't happened before. Usually when banks fail, you get your FDIC insurance portion back and the rest of it you lose. And then that would be a deduction under normal circumstances. So the question is, does it deduct back out or not? So anyway, I want to move on. We also are watching the Credit Suisse situation in Europe, and it's very interesting to look at the European method of banking versus the United States. The idea of stepping in and making depositors whole in Europe is not as well advanced as it is here. There is very serious risk if a bank collapses in Europe that investors would be wiped out. And what's happening is, Credit Suisse is a global bank. People from all over the world put their money into Credit Suisse and other Swiss banks because of Switzerland's long history of banking stability. It's just one of the three pillars of the Swiss economy is the Swiss banks and gold, the gold gnomes of Zurich, and also Swiss watches, which I think I mentioned yesterday. So when people from all over the world, Asia, wherever, put their money into these banks, and they start to get nervous and pull it out, they don't have the backstops that we have. So it becomes a very interesting problem as to what is going to happen. So we're really watching the liquidity problems of Credit Suisse, although the federal national bank in Switzerland is stated that it will be there. But it's very interesting to watch what happens to the depositors in that situation. So I think we're going to keep an eye on that. You'll probably hear more about that next week. One thing I did notice while I was searching the news today is that the Chinese gold market in Shanghai and London, it's more and more linked, and there's a wholesale gold market that happens in China. And effectively what they do is that gold is sold at wholesale for manufacture of jewelry and also individual purchases. But the story was that gold purchases in the wholesale market surged in February. And you get to think, thinking about that, that's a very international market. And what it tells you is people around the world continue to buy gold, whether it's in India for jewelry or for family purposes. And Chinese, it's 6,000 years ago, the Chinese were buying gold. What it tells you is that the global demand for gold has not declined. So, if you're thinking about adding gold to your portfolio, you would probably want to call Swiss America at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them for their free investor guide. And they'll mail it to you and you read it and you can learn something. And you're going to learn a lot about the gold market. You can see that people around the world are purchasing precious metals as a store of value. And I think as Americans, I talked about that wealth pyramid yesterday with land and precious metals. And then the next step, of course, is currency, dollars and coins and this and that. But as you assemble that pyramid of your wealth based on your circumstances and your risk tolerance, those certain bedrock elements like land and precious metals and cash are things that don't depreciate and effectively are valuable to people. So, if the Chinese are buying gold, maybe you ought to take a look and see if that's right for you. So also, I wanted to comment on that Silicon Valley Bank situation. There's a story in the news today that SVB Financial files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Well, that's an interesting story. And everyone, one of my friends said, well, I thought the bank went broke. They closed it. Well, here's how these things are structured. In today's modern world, you will have a holding company. And the holding company is a corporation that is the corporation that has its shares trading on Wall Street. Okay, so if you buy SVB Financial, those are the shares you're buying. And that holding company has different subsidiaries. One of them was SVB Bank, the bank subsidiary, which is what closed. It's the part that is a separate entity. It's regulated. It's highly regulated with respect to pulling capital out to another subsidiary or putting it in, very tightly regulated. And that subsidiary just poof, that's done. They do have other subsidiaries. They have a broker-dealer subsidiary that helps people buy and sell stocks. And they also have a venture capital subsidiary. You can imagine that would make sense, being SVB Bank in Silicon Valley. Venture capital is a big deal, and that bank was participating. Well, that entity is still functioning. Just because the bank subsidiary blew out, the others are still functioning. So what is SVB Financial is doing is effectively reorganizing its operations under Chapter 11. And if and when it emerges, Chapter 7 is where you file for bankruptcy and you're done. You go broke, you liquidate, you closed. 11 is a reorg with the idea that after the reorganization, you're going to come out and you're going to function again. And that's what's happening. So what they're doing now is planning for the future and entering into this restructuring. And it will look much different when it comes out. It might be a subsidiary of somebody else, but the bank itself is done. So that's what that's all about. One of the things I wanted to talk about with this JP Morgan situation, I'm sort of a fan of history, and I think if you find joy in reading the history of banks, it's probably not the most dynamic life, but I find it fascinating. And when you look at how the United States emerged as from a colonial place with colonies to an independence to a republican form of government, basically we're a republic with elected officials. We've always had a strong interest in mercantile, which is manufacturing. Mercantile is selling from merchants and manufacturing and farming and shipping and all those components that create a modern society. And banking has always been a very important part of that. But you have to keep in mind, we didn't just start, in a wooden hut on Plymouth Rock. There was a lot of banking going on in England for centuries before. So banking itself is a very sophisticated process. And when you come to the U.S., we started this whole economy and created banks. There are multiple interests, and the banks are owned primarily by shareholders. Okay, and shareholders are the primary constituency. When you buy shares in a bank, it's the idea that the bank will grow. And how does a bank grow? Well, it has to have revenues, and it has to manage its expenses, and then there has to be income. And of course, that income is a percentage of the equity of the bank, and that's your return on equity. And as that return on equity grows, at least according to classic valuation theory, the value of your stock will grow as well. And you add a speculative component in, and that's why people buy shares of banks, because they want to see growth in the value of those shares and perhaps a dividend. So there's the shareholder component. And then, of course, the banking itself has depositors who put their money into a bank for safekeeping. And that's always been the big problem, is that you put your money into a bank for safekeeping and they'd fail. You'd lose your money. And that's always the big risk to a depositor. Will I get my money back? And that was why the federal, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, was created in 1933, was to insure the deposits of average Americans so that if the banks failed, the average Americans would get their money back, at least up to a point. And at that point today is $250,000. And then, of course, you have the customers of the bank. And these are the people who want to borrow money either to buy something like a car or a boat or whatever, consumer lending, or they want to borrow money to start a business or expand their business or run their business or whatever. And of course, running businesses is risky. We know that the rate of business failure in America historically is very high. There's a better than 50% chance that a company, will not last more than 100 years. I mean, it's very difficult to find very old companies because the economy is dynamic, the marketplace is dynamic, and economists will look at sort of a short run and a long run. And when you look at the history of a company, the long run is a long run, but it's not infinity. So if you think about it, you can name very, very few companies that still exist from the 1700s and early 1800s in America, because things come and things go. And that's the whole concept of banking. So you got to keep all these balls in the air. You got to keep the shareholders happy when the depositors are coming in, and the way to get depositors is to offer a nice high interest rate or a free toaster or whatever you do to entice them in, and they put their money on deposit. And then, of course, from the lending side, the borrowers want the lowest possible interest rate, so they're squeezing you on the interest rate here, and the depositors are just squeezing you on the other side for higher interest rates, and the shareholders are the beneficiaries in the middle. And that's the complexity of banking. So when we start to see things that trigger a massive outflow of deposits, so the bank's capital reserves drop below a certain point, they have to take the walk of shame over to the Fed's window, where the Fed is the lender of last resort, and then the Fed will lend them money to true up the ratios at a premium, and with the idea that you're going to get your bank back in balance. And that's why banks tend to compete with each other for interest rates or premiums, like toasters or blankets, whatever they hand out. And at the same time, as a young banker, you want to have a great big portfolio of people borrowing from you. But the risk and the career killer is, you know, you lend to people who can't pay it back, and that's bad. So that's the dynamic that there is in the banking industry. And you know, it's interesting that J.P. Morgan Chase is still the biggest player in this economy. It's the largest bank in the United States, super strong, super well done. They have an amazing online platform if you're running a small business. Their digital online platform is really something, and it's a big deal. But I think back, because I like to read history of banking. When you think about John Pierpont Morgan himself, well, J.P. Morgan, you know, back in the 1800s, the guy was the dynamic player. And by the time the panic of 1907 came around, he was the guy who saved basically the American economy by stepping up and putting his money in to keep other banks from failing, from the New York Stock Exchange from collapsing. He was sort of like the, you know, like the Elon Musk of his day. I mean, this guy stepped in and he stopped the panic. And of course, he's a legendary figure, and it's fascinating reading to see what he did. But it's interesting to see J.P. Morgan stepping in today to save First Republic Bank, because I don't know if it's his ghost or his legacy or what, but once again, that very famous name steps in creatively to take individual risk rather than shunting to the government. That's why that 11-bank consortium led by Chase, and I'm not sponsored by Chase, I'm not advertising, then you can bank wherever you want, but it's just from a historic perspective how that name is very, very powerful in banking. And once again, so it's an interesting thing to see. I did notice that the banks, it was kind of an interesting story, they borrowed $158 billion from the Fed's open window last week. And then the week before, it was only $400 billion. So from, excuse me, $4 billion to $158 billion in a week. That was the surge of banks running to the Fed and taking out these emergency loans. It's huge, from $4 billion to $158 billion. It just shows you the impact of of this situation. And I'm hoping next week we'll be able to talk about other things other than just the constant banking. But it's important to know, because as you put your money into, you know, put it to work for you, you kind of need to be following the structuring. And we are in a period right now of very intense restructuring. We saw that in 2008. And of course, we saw it in 2000. We saw it, you know, in the 1980s. If you track, you know, the bank problems throughout history, these things tend to be a 15-year cycle, and we're here now. So anyway, give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271. Ask them for their free investor guide and take a look. This is probably a good time to be thinking about diversification of your portfolio, and this is a good place to do it. So anyway, with that, have a great St. Patrick's Day and a safe weekend, and I'll be back Monday morning with hopefully lots of good news. We'll call it Good News Monday. So anyway, have a great weekend, and thanks a lot. Talk to you later. Bye.